Tell me, I've looked at your Instagram and I've looked at your story, but it's pretty cryptic. Tell me about you and how, why you set up your Instagram to do with mental health. What do I need to know? What does everyone need to know?
It's useful to hear that it's coming across as cryptic, because clearly I need to communicate my story better then. my story, it's kind of long to explain. I've had a journey with depression and anxiety since I was about 18 years old. I'm 25 now. Been through highs and lows with it, including an extremely low point during lockdown where I was at the point of suicide. I'd pretty much like written a note and planned it. I never went through with it, but yeah, I was very caught up in a incredibly low period of depression between 2019 and 2020. And then, yeah, it's sort of been up and down since then. The depression has sort of manifested itself in new ways, as has the anxiety. So I call it generalized anxiety disorder. And then, yeah, the Insta and the TikTok were in part me wanting to share my journey with that, to help others with what I've learned. It's also partly my own sort of therapeutic thing in some ways. Can be very useful with depression to help others. Also because I've become disenfranchised with this world of work and the conventional working path of being employed by someone else. I became highly, highly disillusioned with it after graduating 2 years ago, and saw this as an opportunity for me to perhaps become a content creator to help others with their mental health and their general personal development, but also make that my line of work as well.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. Do you know, as I was going through your Instagram, do you know what came to mind was you strike me as an anti-hero, in the sense of you're like a hero, but you're not in the traditional sort of clean cut, you're sort of two fingers up to the establishment, sort of, which is literally what you just said. So that makes complete sense. I don't know, I just got this vibe of there's like a sort of a Deadpool sort of taking the mic sort of satirical to the establishment. So does that align with you? Do you sort of get where I'm going at, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, it tickles my ego, you saying that, but yeah, that is very much.
It's a good point. Yeah.
It's very interesting to hear that you've had that observation of it. Just yeah, it's accurate. I've never used the term anti-hero, okay, but I can fully understand why that would be used. For me, being maverick and anti-establishment is part of my personality. It always has been.
Yeah.
I despise authority. I despise groupthink, and often I can be quite critical of popular culture. Mm-hmm. And growing up at school, I was always getting in trouble with teachers because I just didn't respect the arbitrary authority that came with it. And that manifests itself often through the communication that you see around mental health and social media too. So yeah, it's also combined with the fact that I am naturally quite cheeky. I'm quite cocky and cheeky, and my core self is a joker, and I like to take the piss and banter and mess around. And that can translate itself differently. Sometimes it can be quite cynical and sardonic and deadpan in the way that I communicate. And a lot of people, they struggle to recognize that, particularly on TikTok. They seriously don't understand that I'm making a joke a lot of the time when I'm talking about things. But I think it's an important way to communicate it, because it's more relatable for some people than just being serious, like a therapist and a medical practitioner, where they just don't really have any personality. It's just, this is the fact, this is the data. I'll leave that to the scientist. Like, my own story and the way that I document my experiences with mental health, I want to be presented in a more human and real way, I guess.
That makes sense. And your sense of humor is the idiot always becomes the fool is the precursor to the master from a mythological perspective. So you can't become the master unless you're willing to be the sort of joker and the fool. So that's complete. That makes sense, which is why superheroes do all these little quirks and quicks, or whatever the word is, when they find their villains. I don't know why I've gone down the hero route, but so that's you. So you're obviously somewhat of a disagreeable person. As you said, you don't like authority, but yet you're interested in helping others. And that's always, I suppose to some degree I'm like that, but growing up at school, I was a very obedient person. So it makes sense why, because there's a personality trait, agreeableness. I don't know if you know about the Big Five personality model. It's really interesting. I love it so much. And one of the personality traits is agreeableness, and agreeable people are polite and compassionate. So you're clearly very compassionate, but you're not very polite, which is a cool mixture actually, because it means that you care about people, but you're not I don't mean polite as in you're rude, but as in you're not going to go along with something if you don't think you're going to stick your head out above the parafis or whatever the word, I don't know. You know what I mean? And Russell Brand's a bit like that. Lots of characters. It's a great attribute to have the compassion, but to not be polite, because often compassionate people are polite, so they'll just go along with the bullshit. And that's where the society can fall apart, because the bullshit is allowed to spread because the compassionate people go along with the bullshit.
I'm aware of the Big Five model. A criticism that people have of me is that I'm rude. Yeah. And that I'm a disruptor. And this is why many of my teachers disliked me. The head teacher that I had at school, who still to this day I would say is a fucking arsehole, he and I didn't get on at all. He despised me, and he tried to punish me at whatever opportunity he could, because I was a disruptor and I would challenge his authority as the principal of secondary school when I was just a student. And this is that thing that I have. I'm not afraid to call out arbitrary authority and what I see is wrong. I'm very principled in that sense. But yes, also I do, a lot of the time it comes from a recognition that I can see that the way that people are doing things isn't helping others. Like it's a bigger picture way of thinking that this authority and the way that people are thinking, the way they're looking at things, the way they're talking about things are going to have a negative effect on various people. And obviously there is the selfish element involved in it too, that all humans have a degree of self-interest in what they're doing. But yeah, you need people that are going to put their head above the parapet and call it out. And yeah, again, like the compassionate and kind people can quite easily be walked
over. Yeah, definitely.
In that sense. But they're also, often I find they're a bit more rational and level-headed. Like I can be pretty emotional and hot-headed with things, and it doesn't always land me in good positions. Like my disruptiveness and my maverick behavior at times has landed me in trouble with authority, unsurprisingly, particularly at school and in the workplace, because people don't like it and they feel threatened by it, and they will try and silence it when they can. Also being rude as well, it's not something to be maybe proud of. Like I can be very polite, I can be very kind, but it's sometimes it's hard to tell where the way that you're coming across. And that's the beauty of having different personality types, is someone that is lighter will be able to on one that is rude.
100%. Because part of the predicament that you can face if you're not very polite is that sometimes the truth needs to be said, but you can demonize yourself too early on, and then it's not beneficial for you. And it's sort of, you have to, you know, it's like I learned about minority influence when I did psychology, and it's the way that minority influence has to, they can't put themselves out there too much, because otherwise they'll get squashed down and then they won't be able to get anywhere. They have to slowly sort of slightly mimic the or mirror what's going on the other side and shift their way through. And you know, if you put out ideas, I've learned that, you know, things I want to say, I think, yeah, A, I don't really know if I actually think that. B, it's probably not true. And C, as much as I think I'm saying the right thing, it may in the long run actually be not helpful. But then you run the risk of, you've got to say what's got to be said at the time. So it's all complicated, as everything is.
Yeah, it's quite an intellectual way to look at it. Like, it's smart to have that level of self-awareness in what you're doing, and also the ability to drop your ego and say, oh, actually, my thoughts probably are wrong. How do I know that it's right? People want to be right all the time. They want to have opinions on things, but like, very often the most intellectually respectable stance is to just say, I don't know, and to let it pass, and also recognize that your thoughts could change. Do you actually agree with what your thought, the thought that has arisen in that moment, or could it change? A lot of the time, thoughts do change, but too many people have an egoic attachment to their ideas and their thoughts, and how that forms their notion of who they are and their personality, and they can't let it go. And, you know, ultimately we need to be able to be moldable and to develop and change and let things go, because that will help us to grow.
Absolutely. That's Carl Jung said. Do you know Carl Jung? Psychologist, psychoanalysis. Yeah, he said, people don't have ideas, ideas have people. And I think that's a brilliant, brilliant thing.
Yeah,
and one of the problems that the liberal people tend to be creative people. And what's so ironic about modern liberalism is that modern liberalism is almost more constrained than conservatism is. And that's, it goes completely against what they are in theory are about. So, you know, the idea of identifying people based upon their group is an incredibly restrictive way of looking at people. And that's not what liberalism is supposed to be about. So it's, you know, it's an interesting, politics is a very interesting thing. The political dilemmas is incredible. I found out the other day, you know, the term political correctness, what that originated in Soviet Russia, and what it meant was, what you're saying is correct, but it's not correct to the political party, so you can't say it. So isn't that an incredible, I thought, wow, that's unbelievable. So it's, what you're saying may be factually correct, but it's not correct to the party line, so you can't say it. And, you know, Soviet Russia was, to say a catastrophe would be an understatement, because more people died in Soviet Russia than died in Nazi Germany. I think a lot more, like at least multiple times more. So, yeah, but we won't go down politics, because screw that. We'll stick to the individual, because that's what I care about. That's what is important. And clearly you recognize that. Do you know what possibly set off your anxiety when you were 18? And what year was it when you were 18? 2020? Oh, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. COVID, wasn't it? Is that what it was?
No, too far. No, it's 2000.
Okay. Oh, yes, of course, because you're...
It would have been.
Are you older than me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but... So I'm 25. My anxiety, I was diagnosed with GAD when I was 19. I've always been neurotic, so that is another character trait that I have, is like trait neuroticism. That for me is a learned behavior from my parents. I also think there may be a biological element to it. I mean, my knowledge of neurochemistry and sort of biopsychology is pretty limited. But I've always had a nervous gut, for example. And obviously the gut-brain axis is very closely linked. But I also think, so I kind of wonder if there is a anatomical element to my anxiety. But I also believe it is a product of socialization from my parents, who were just chronic worriers, which it's a difficult one, because it's a very strong character trait to have, but it's fucking unfair on a child to be exposed to that, because you will raise that child to have a default psychological mechanism of concern, of worry all the time, which is not helpful for that child. It makes them anxious all the time, and it makes them prone to negativity. Why that then ended up manifesting itself as GAD, as generalized anxiety disorder, I'm not entirely sure. My mental health declined as I got older, but yeah, that for me is probably the main cause of where it stems from. Although my anxiety isn't as bad now, I would say my depression is more the issue. I've got slightly better at managing my anxiety. A lot of it to do with lifestyle. Absolutely. As well. But the depression is
difficult. I've always found, because I've suffered from anxiety since I was as young as I can remember. My mum's very, very neurotic, definitely. My dad is kind of as well, but he's a bit more stable now. So you're right, socialization is really important. This is something that I learned from, I've kind of learned myself working with kids, because that's what I've done since I was kind of 18 on and off. And from Jordan Peterson, it's if you take children who are predisposed to anxiety, the default is to protect them because they're afraid of everything. But all that does is reinforce their anxiety. So you actually have to encourage them and implore them to be more adventurous and more assertive in their behavior. And obviously it's a mismatch of what you would assume is the correct thing to do. So that's difficult. And I can imagine, it's hard growing up being a young male nowadays. So I imagine that could be part of the onset of why you became anxious I've always found that when I'm anxious, I'm not depressed, because anxiety is kind of a purpose in some weird sense. It's a comparison of an ideal maybe, or along those lines. But then when you're feeling depressed, you're not anxious, because when you're depressed, I can become a bit nihilistic. So it's a shame if you could take the good from one and the good from the other and put them together, you could make quite a good way of living. But unfortunately, they seem to, well, obviously they come at the wrong time and separately. So you get the negativity bias, which we all have because we're human beings and it's what's kept us alive. So without going to as much detail as you got anything to say about that, just speak over me, because otherwise I'll probably just go on too much and it's not about me, it's about you. So
I'm intrigued to hear your analysis and your thoughts too. The relationship between anxiety and depression is complicated. You know, they seem to sort of feed off each other really, and the negative thinking patterns that you can experience as a result of both, i.e. like catastrophizing, black and white thinking, they very much sort of cross over with each other. And normally the way that I look at it, unfortunately, is, you know, am I in more of a state of anxiety or am I in more of a state of depression, rather than it sort of being neither. Because it always seems to be that one of them is more prominent. I think the identification with those conditions as well is an interesting thing. The way that you become caught in the story of depression, I think it's Sam Harris that has used this way of describing it before, is speaking about how depression is essentially when someone becomes stuck in a story that is just being replayed consistently in their mind. And from what I understand, again, I think that the neurochemistry can show that can lead to the formation of certain neuropathways or the destruction of certain neuropathways that then literally bring that person, they're entrenched in it. It's like they become so sort of stuck in your mind, and that is where you are, that it's very hard to untangle yourself from it even. And that's where certain substances like psychedelics have been shown to be particularly effective at treating these conditions, because they can unwind and like sort of untangle the chaos or rebuild those neuro pathways. And that is something that I can sort of relate to, in that being stuck in it, because the way that I experience depression, anxiety quite often is a sort of voice in my head being, oh, I am depressed, I have depression, I am anxious, I have anxiety. Again, it's that sort of egoic affiliation with the condition. And when you hear people that speak about things from a sort of mindfulness-based approach, like Eckhart Tolle and people that have sort of delved into Buddhism, etc., they'll often speak more in the context of there is anxiety, there is depression, rather than I am depressed, I am anxious. Yeah. But for me, I'm very much up and identifying with those conditions, and I've never really been able to sort of unwind from that. But that in itself is probably an egoic pursuit,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
It does, but it's really complicated. When our way of conceptualizing emotions and drives and motivations, I think we've actually regressed. The notion, obviously we haven't scientifically, but the notion that there's chemicals going on in our brain which is making us to feel like this isn't as powerful as the way, say, the Greeks saw it, or people from a mythological perspective. The notion that not I am depressed, but instead of saying I am imbued with the god of depression or the god of sadness, is, in a way, it's a better way of, it's a more accurate way, certainly a more accurate way from a sort of phenomenological sense of, to say that, you know, or rage or lust or all these things are imbued with the god, instead of going, your brain is, all these little things are firing in your brain, and at the moment you feel like this, or this is, it is you. A more helpful way could be for people, you know, because people think, oh, that was stupid. How could they possibly think that gods were telling them to, you know? But I mean, if you've become incredibly angry, if you were told, without any scientific knowledge, if someone told you a god is pulling your strings, given maybe the environment, or I don't know, I just feel like that is something that you could go, yeah, that does kind of make sense, actually, more than there's little chemical things going on in your brain which are causing you to act like this, because it's such a stark, powerful thing. So I think you're exactly right. We've got to move away from this ascribing ourselves to our emotions all the time. And we run the risk. We're very solipsistic. Do you know what that means, solipsistic? I only found out what that word means quite... It means... Yeah. Solipsism, incredible. I didn't know there was an actual word for this. It means my feelings are my reality. So if you're solipsistic, you think that your feelings are your reality. So the way you feel now is the truth. And I think even more so, regardless of other people. So it's kind of like a selfish thing as well. But we're sort of being programmed to, you know, really... It's hard, because when you are panicking, I do think a better tactic than, because people used to tell me, Ollie, just don't let your brain go there, just do something else. And I used to think, okay. And then but other people said, no, you've got to go into it, go into the panic as deep as you can, really feel it. So it's a balance. It's not a balance, but in some ways you need to go into it, your emotions, and in other ways you need to withdraw from them. But that was another long spiel. But I think the key being the idea of gods as emotions is cool.
No, that's... Yeah, it is very interesting. I mean, like, deities as a means of explaining our interpretation of the world is something that we
do now without even realizing it.
It's really until and so many people do. And I mean, even like not just deities, but in sort of constructs of the mind and the idea of like how Yuval Harari describes Marxism as religion, for example, or capitalism as religion, in the same way as a monotheistic Abrahamic religion is a religion. Like, a lot of the time we use these sort of abstract ideas they're not even abstract, these ideological constructs to explain ideologies, even for better words, to understand and interpret the world, which almost seems like a distraction from what I sense that there is a sort of deeper reality to it, which I guess maybe for me is, well, ironically, something that one of these ideologies, Buddhism, talks about itself in terms of like present moment, being able to sort of step back away from those things, and sort of come back to the point you
said,
solipsism. So it's really interesting to hear you bring that up, because prior to coming on here, I was walking in town and I was sort of thinking and listening a bit to sort of like get my mind ready for having this sort of chat. And one of the thoughts that randomly came up was, I have very much noticed in my experience of depression and anxiety that it is more often than not a feeling problem rather than a thinking problem, which is perhaps why I had CBT, by the way, and it didn't work for me. I thought it was far too surface level. It probably sounds a bit elitist, but I basically got the impression that it would work for somebody that wasn't as
I think you're no, I, that's not. I think you're completely spot on. It's one of the things that I've worried about is you've got to be shit hot, because everywhere you go, I probably have already gone, mate. So yeah, carry on. Yeah, I completely agree.
So I felt fucking exasperated after having CBT and it being like, oh, well, this is supposedly one of the most effective forms of therapy. But I was like, well, do you know what? I don't really want to sort of quantify my thoughts and sort of score myself on, oh, I feel 40% less anxious today. No, that's not how my fucking mind works. and challenging the thought itself just didn't seem to work. I was listening to a podcast recently. I've forgotten who the expert was, but it was some professor of psychology or something along those lines who knows a lot about anxiety. And he was saying this as well, in that one of the problems that you have with anxiety so often is you're taught to challenge the thought, but it's not a thinking problem. It is a feeling problem closely relating to the central nervous system and the release of the chemicals as a result of it, because it is our survival mechanism. And that's why more often than not, it's better to try and address feelings of anxiety through techniques such as your breathing regulation and grounding and touching, rather than just using sort of thought challenging processes. Because one thing that I've found with this is often I feel like I'm just looking at things intellectually. It's like I have this intellectual understanding and it's looking at it from a rational perspective, but rationality and logic doesn't actually help the feeling. It allows me to understand what is going on that intellectual level, but I don't actually feel any better. I still feel depressed. I still feel low. I still feel sadness. I still feel worry. So it's like, how do I find the coping mechanisms that address that feeling element more, and being able to not identify with the feeling so much, as you said there in
I think one of the fact that CBT has made its way as the sort of preeminent, most popular form of therapy, it speaks to our society's, Western society's tendency to be over rational and to be the word's a priori, but I always forget which way around it is, over rational and to ignore consciously ignore the somewhat the fanciful, or the fantasy is the wrong term, because you become you move into the realm of gobbledygook. But it's we neglect the importance of something other than the intellect, and we neglect the importance of being embodied, and or at least consciously we do. Subconsciously we still crave it, which is why we love football, and why we love sports, and why we love drama, and why we love music, because that's the subconscious craving for that which isn't expressible by words. And you're completely right. The thing about CBT is there's a subconscious element. It's not a solely conscious issue. It's a subconscious issue, especially if something's been instantiated in you over and over and over again, which it usually has for someone to end up in therapy. You know, You don't have one bad experience and go, right, I'm off to therapy. You've got to have, most people have, unless it's a traumatic event, truly traumatic event, but most people have repeated. And then, you know, I did something called EFT, which is emotional freedom techniques. It's a bit like acupuncture, but it's acupressure. I know you want to say something, so I'll let you go.
No, it's fine. I had acupuncture as well, actually. My parents are very much advocates of sort of Eastern medicine and the Eastern philosophies. Unfortunately, acupuncture didn't do anything.
Except leave holes in.
Left holes in me. And yeah, I think after the first session, I felt slightly more relaxed, but it didn't really do a lot for me. I mean, although that said, like, my acupuncture supposedly was targeted more at my skin, which in itself is another point, actually, I forgot to mention, which is closely related
we should
to
talk
this
about.
Type. I have irritable bowel syndrome, and I also have two chronic skin conditions, which I personally all believe are linked holistically to whatever is going on between my mind and body. But they definitely play into the low mood at times.
Absolutely, yeah. The skin thing is mad, because I'm completely like you. I've suffered from IBS pretty badly, partially because I've been on antibiotics since I was about 12, on and off, and I've also had massive skin issues, but basically only with acne, but, you know, at times pretty severe. And it's amazing how, you know, the medical community know that your skin is a reflection of your internal state, but they never treat it as if it's an inflection of your internal state. They treat it as if it's a separate thing, which is so stupid. It's like, well, we know that the skin is a mirror of what's going on internally. So why don't you address what's going on internally as opposed to just treating the symptoms? But yeah, when did the IBS, is that's presumably linked to anxiety and panic, because you've got the brain gut barrier breaking down as a result of stress, and then all these bad bacteria flood into the small bowel and it's a nightmare. What am I going to say? What sort of things do you get worried about, or did you get worried about? If you don't, you don't have to say if you don't want to, but what is it, just with that in general, what sort of things do you think has led to you being generalized anxiety disorder? Why did you go to doctors and say, I'm really struggling? What was on your mind?
So it was the depression that I went there for initially. But my main with GAD was, in public, I always assumed that people were looking at me. If I heard someone laughing, I would immediately default to they are laughing at me. I would just, as GAD is like generalized, I would just over worry about absolutely everything, like my exams, you know, financial situation, what people are thinking of me, like the social dynamics, the social anxiety element. I think that IBS really contributed to it, not only because of the, as we've said, the sort of the actual change to the gut, the whatever is going on with the microbiome there, but I also developed a real worry with IBS because my form of IBS is IBS diarrhea. So there were a few occasions just before I got diagnosed with it where like I basically just came extremely close to shitting myself, which like is obviously an incredibly like embarrassing thing to happen. And I sort of became worried all the time, oh, you know, I could eat this food that isn't going to sit well, and then I urgently have to use the toilet. What if I can't find the toilet? And this is the interesting thing with IBS and anxiety is that often the mental state plays into it. That level of worry, I have nowhere near as much now. I'm a lot more at ease with it. And my IBS is better. A lot of it due to me changing diet. But yeah, I think that was a huge part of it was the worry that came around that. But yeah, just in general, you know, like I said, the socialization that I had from my parents, like I probably learned from a young age to immediately worry as a means of trying to understand and sort of see the next steps. And that unfortunately has just become a fucking cognitive pattern that I've been socialized into and is a default. But yeah, I think the worry was pretty much everything. The worry in more recent years has been a lot more financial. My anxiety and my mental health actually is sort of latched on my mental illness, even not mental health, has latched onto financial concern quite a lot over the last few years. Particularly in a form of resentment and anger and frustration and bitterness. Whereas in the past, it was actually like, I was genuinely worried. When I first came out of uni, I was like, oh, fuck, like, you know, where is my money going to come from? I have to pay rent, I have to pay bills, et cetera, et cetera. Last year or so, I've been in more comfortable living situations. I've had lodging agreements, so I haven't been tied in by tenancies, et cetera. I've just sort of not worried so much about losing my job. Like if I do lose one, more confident that I'd be able to find a new one, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, in the past, there's been a lot of worry about finances, which is hardly surprising for a Gen Z in fucking 2023.
Very true. Very, very true. It's a nightmare, isn't it? When you say like resentment and bitter, is that resentment of your financial situation? Is that what you mean? Or is it resentment of other things?
Yeah, so it's a lot of different things. And this is another unfortunate default thinking pattern that I've learned is my parents, they're very pessimistic, particularly my dad. My mum was very anxious. My dad was anxious too, but slightly more under control. But my dad was incredibly pessimistic and negative. And I definitely learned from them a sort of resentment for the world. My dad in particular is very bitter about his financial situation. I'd say, but probably a bit of a bitter intellectual, very intelligent guy, but has never made any money. As is often the intellectual people, there's a sort of intellectual ceiling. And there was often this sort of like blame and resentment for the world around and the way that people think, and you know, everybody else is a fucking idiot. You know, like they don't deserve to be better off than me. This world is unfair, et cetera, which I do think there is an element of truth to those things to a degree. But unfortunately, some people, from what I've observed, they will grow up in an environment where if there is a problem, they will be, their default will be, how do I solve this? What can I do to address this? Rather than getting hung up and dwelling on it. And that isn't the way that I think. My default is, if there is a problem, to point the finger and to blame and to get annoyed and to get angry, to get to worry, to feel resentment, to feel sadness, bitterness, to want to withdraw cynicism, all these sort of negative emotions. And I recognize it. That's the jarring thing as well, as I recognize where I've learned that from, and that is the way that I think. And I try to address that when I can. But when that is the default that you resort to, it's not a particularly enjoyable way to live.
Definitely not. That being your default reaction to things is hard. I think I'm a bit like that. Less so as I've probably, like you, as I become more aware of the tendency. I think everyone can have a tendency to be like that. You know, Jordan Peterson talks, or not Jordan Peterson, the Bible's got the story of Cain and Abel, which is of the two brothers who both make sacrifices, and one of them is rewarded by the sacrifices that they make, that they offer to God, and the other isn't. And Cain isn't rewarded, and he becomes resentful of Abel, and then he kills him. And that's kind of like that's a story that has been completely and utterly absorbed into modern culture, because pretty much every single film is a battle of good and evil, quite often with the protagonist and the antagonist being related in some form or another. So, that's a window into the shadow as well. Resentment is a great window into the shadow, the Jungian shadow of, because either there's something you need to say, or you need to work on why you're feeling resentment and try and let go of what it is that's holding you back. But that does make complete sense, 100%. So why do you think, I've got some crappy questions. I did look at your Instagram for a while, but it's all gone out of my head now, for some inspiration and stuff. But why do you think there is a growing amount of psychological disease? And I don't mean disease as in illness, I mean dis-ease. That's the same thing, but you get what I mean. Because you've talked about, that is one thing I did remember, you've spoken about the difference between mental health and mental illness and, you know, all these things. So what do you think is causing these issues, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a complicated one. A lot of people will attribute it to social media and a lack of interpersonal interaction. The classic, you know, we're the most connected we've ever been, but we're also the least connected. Some people, I've noticed particular people, commentators on YouTube, they often seem to attribute Gen Z's mental illness to the romanticization and glorification of mental illnesses, which I'm slightly cautious of using those terms to describe it, but I do understand what they're getting at with it. There is definitely an amplification of mental illnesses, and I think a lot of people are exposing themselves to content that isn't making them feel any better. But I also think there are other problems too, in that, like, this generation, Gen Z in particular, they seem to be particularly sort of uninterested and demotivated by the world that we have it. And I can deeply relate to that. One way that I feel depressed and exasperated and anxious with this world is the state that we have to live in that you are a money slave in this world. There is not real free will. There is not real free choice, unless you come from certain backgrounds, for example, where you're financially privileged. And then that's just looking at it on a financial terms, for example. But like for me, you know, the state of existence that we have, again, as Sam Harris has talked about, we over-identify with work. Our purpose is work. This sort of Protestant work ethic, capitalist way of looking at our state of existence, in that we live to work and that is all. Whereas actually Homo sapiens throughout most of their existence didn't. We had more leisure time. We relaxed more. Whereas everything now is about, you know, what do you do for work? You have to go. You have to help somebody else get wealthy. And they choose when you go on holiday. And like when you can take sick leave and how much you get paid, et cetera, et cetera. And also how a lot of work is just fucking meaningless. It's pointless. I often find myself exasperated at the conventional world of work. It just does not incentivize me. It's like, why would I want to spend the next 40 years of my life submitting myself to something that I'm not fulfilled by, that I don't enjoy, when the ultimate goal is to help somebody else get affluent? And I am inherently getting an unfair share of my labor that I contribute to it, if you're going to look at from how a Marxist would be more likely to describe it. And I wouldn't describe myself as a Marxist, but I do heavily sympathize with that perspective of the economic system that we have. So I think a lot of young Gen Zers are disenfranchised with the world of work that we have it. I think social media amplifies the frustration with that. They hear that other people are doing it too. And some of them, they become sort of doomers and they retreat as a result of that. But also there is a sort of amplification of the inequalities that we have, and that other people are living far better lives. And they want to have that and they don't have it and they feel frustrated. Another thing as well that is really common to speak about, but I do think is true, is the fear of discomfort that a lot of people have. The despite us having all these comforts and conveniences, it doesn't seem to have made us feel any better. No, you can get your food ordered to you like that. You can message people like that. Social media, the internet has made things so much more convenient. Convenience culture, the gig economy, etc. There are a lot of people, they don't want to push themselves. They don't want to have difficulty anymore. And I think that's why you see a lot of people advocating these mental health approaches now, where it's like cold shower, get up early, go to the gym, challenge yourself physically and mentally, because there is reward and endorphins and dopamine, etc., to be found in sort of pushing yourself and experiencing discomfort. I know that's quite a bit of a ramble, but yeah, I think it's the causes of mental illness in this generation, they vary person to person, but there are some recurring themes that I see amongst
absolutely
people.
there's a few sort of overarching reasons, but obviously it's very much dependent upon the person to which each reason is resonates or impacts them. I think it was Joe Rogan who said something like, or maybe I'm conflating, but he said there is no life without discomfort, so pick your discomfort. Actually, he didn't say that, I said that, but he says something along the lines of, you know, the Buddhist said that life is suffering, and as soon as we accept, and that's Jordan Peterson, yep. a massive something that underpins Jordan Peterson's espousements. I don't know if that's a word, but life is suffering. So, you know, cold water, exercise, fasting, all these things that we do, they're conscious suffering, because you're going to suffer anyway. So, as you know, depression, I think a lot of you've said this, depression a lot of the time is a lack of meaning or a purpose. So on a previous podcast, I said something like, at the moment we ask people, how are you doing? And that's a stupid question. We should ask people, what have they been doing? In other words, and that puts the emphasis on actions and doing, because, you know, as we alluded to earlier on, everyone has a temperament and a personality. And as Jordan Peterson said, we're like a tree, or a tree, and we have like maybe one or two big trunks or huge branches, that which is like our core personalities. And what we all need to do is kind of build a life that accentuates and aligns with those personalities. So if you're an open person, which we both are, this is a great thing for us to do. And if you're a compassionate person, which we both are, this is also a great thing for us to do. And then if you're, you know, if you're a conscientious, incredibly conscientious person, I suppose it's a bit more versatile, but it's about finding, and I don't mean to reduce it to the big five. I mean, family and parent and children is clearly a massive branch that people have to their tree of them. so to speak. So I think, yeah, the commoditization, or whatever the word is, of our mood has been very detrimental to it, because now it's all dependent upon, you know, external forces, which has, yeah, I lost the loop at the end, but that's all right.
No, I'm with you. I've sort of lost a few sort of, thought patterns as we've had this too. I think there's too much of a reliance on external stimuli and distraction, although an element of distraction can actually be helpful. Like I throughout the past, I always used to be very much of the idea that I need to be introspective all the time and digging and analyzing. But I actually found that quite often that just sort of made me.
Yeah. That will take you down the questioning. That will take you down the path of the arrogance of the intellect. Sorry to interrupt you. That will take you down the path of the arrogance of the intellect. If you spend too much time introspective, you'll fall into a pit, as you said. But anyway, carry on. Sorry to interrupt you there. I just wanted to get that in.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I've got a friend at the moment who's been caught up in a very deep depressive episode for a year because he went through a breakup that just completely fucked him. He's an incredibly sensitive and loving guy. But it's just, this breakup has really rocked him. But he is also a very introspective and analytical guy, similar to yourself, very interested in Jungian philosophy. He has always been a bit of a psychonaut as well. So he's dabbled a lot with psychedelics for the purposes of intellectual and spiritual learning. And we speak quite often, and he lately, you know, he's been asking me, he's been saying, you know, do you find yourself falling into existentialism? Do you find yourself doing this and this? Have you read this philosopher? And I just said to him, mate, honestly, if I can give you one advice, sometimes I've found that when I'm in the midst of depression and anxiety, it's best for me to focus my energy on something that isn't related to trying to understand what is happening, because you are intellectualizing it. You're trying to outthink the thinker, and it's only going to send you one way, and that's downwards. And that actually, you know, maybe it is better in that moment to just sort of watch a video watching like Postecoglou having his latest interview after the Bournemouth game. For me, like
you are. Oh, you absolute legend.
Like, for me, I might actually. I find this, for example, like sometimes I would at night, if I was going to watch something, I'd be listening to Eckhart Tolle speaking about the depths of depression, or Jungian philosophy talking about the shadow self. But I actually find maybe I feel better if I just watch like Postecoglou having an interview post game and like learning more about the analysis of football that is going on there. Yeah, it might not be as intellectually respectable talking about
who cares
football,
who cares.
I actually feel better.
Yeah,
exactly. And who cares?
You're spot on. Sorry. And as I think I alluded to earlier, that's why we love like the arts and sports, because it's a way of. We are almost engaging in an intellectual open thing entity, but in an embodied sense rather than an intellectual sense. So, you know, I'll watch the Premier League highlights some respite from whatever it is I'm doing at the moment. And it's really important to not over intellectualize everything and to not underestimate the being aspect of who we are. I just want to go back to the thing that you said about your friend. I think this little proverb, whatever it is like one of my favorite things that I've learned throughout all of this, throughout the whole sort of self-help, whatever you want to call it, journey. There's a guy is on the walking on the beach. I think it was Socrates or something. It's probably a made up story and someone's just put some Greek philosopher name in. I think someone was walking across the beach one day and he saw this guy in the distance running back and forth, running to the sea, back into inland a bit, very back and forth like a bucket. And he went over to see what he was doing. And he said, I'm trying. And the guy dug a hole and he said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm trying to fill the sea, trying to fill this hole with all the sea. I'm seeing how far I can get. And he's like, what are you on about? This is the sea. It's massive. That's a tiny little hole. You can't fill all the water of the sea in that hole. And the point of it is one mind can't contemplate or hold the entire intellectual and sort of philosophical arsenal, to use a satanic term. There's no point. Don't try. Don't try and get hold of everything, because you can't. And this is the thing, as human beings, we have to learn to close doors on things. I think you can't let every problem bother you. If that's where, you know, I don't really care about climate change. I probably should, but I just don't, because it doesn't call to me. Whereas these sort of things call to me, and you know, I could research it more, but I'm like, nah, that's all right, because that's not where my skills lie. This is where my skills lie. I'm going to let someone else focus on climate control and work that out. Yeah. Do you get what I mean?
It's really interesting to hear you say that.
Yeah.
I'm exactly the same, and I also have a sense of guilt from it, because one, I do recognize that climate change is real.
Yeah,
by no means am I deny it. I see it as a serious problem
again
that is happening. But I don't have that urge, that pull, that desire to act on it. A lot of people do, and that's the thing. Same as you, I'm like, I'll leave them to it. For me, my calling, my social cause is mental health. And that, I think that's just the way that it is. We have our
differences
that we're more drawn to in that sense. And this is where my skills lie in speaking about this. So I just would, I'll do what I can and listen to the experts on it. One of my best mates is an environmental consultant, for example. So if there is something relating to climate change and I want a rational opinion, I'll ask him. And I've got various mates that are climate activists, so you know, I'll let them do it and speak to them and hear what they would recommend, but also respect that pretty much that's their area of expertise and this is mine.
What was or what have been your breaking points? Because I don't know if I probably haven't said, but the name of the podcast is the Breaking Point Podcast.
Sure. So what is in like the lowest points, what brought me to my depths? Yeah, sure. So
I mean,
carry on if there's more you want to add.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be the lowest point. It could be just a point of mass reflection and mass desire to change.
Yeah. So I'll incorporate a mix of both, because in
sounds
terms
good.
Of like in terms of the lowest point, lockdown sent me into the absolute depths of despair. In the second lockdown in the winter, I entered a serious rut where I was living nocturnally, but also sleeping like 12 to 14 hours a day, / not being able to get out of bed. I was just stoned all the time. I had no motivation to do anything. I had a full body flare up of psoriasis, like the worst breakout of skin I've ever had. I ended up having to go and getting therapy for it, like UV therapy, where you literally like stand in a sunbed and you just do it. Yeah, like 3 times a week, just to get rid of it. It was awful. Just had this intense sinking sadness in my chest. I'd lost hope. Like I was completely broken, a shell of what I was. Really, really exposed to the sort of darkest depths of what the mind can do. And then I came sort of close to that again when I graduated. Like I sort of my identity changed. I was no longer a student. I'm in the real world. What do I do? I was in Leeds at the time. All my mates were moving to London. I was stuck here. I didn't want to be here. I was sort of, I didn't have security. I was hopping around houses. The jobs that I was doing, I despised. It was like customer service and temporary recruitment roles, fully office based, that were just so below what I was stimulated by. I was really depressed again then, which sort of leads to where I'm at now in terms of breaking out, breaking point and the desire for change. The more recent breaking points that I've had, I've been on sick leave with my current job for 3 months now. I unfortunately have to go back next week because my pay will get brought down by half if I don't. But this has also sort of been a breaking point and a point of reflection for me, is moving to London and getting a corporate job for the largest news company in the world and realizing that they do not give a flying fuck about their employers. They make loads of money. Their C-suite are profiting. The staff turnover rate is awful. Productivity has dropped. Staff are discontent because they're not paid enough. And we see this around with greedflation and everything that's happened now. This, for me, whilst also the YouTube algorithm helping me out and throwing me up the likes of Dan Coe, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but a lot of these sort of like creator economy influencers, I highly recommend Dan Coe. We can chat about it after the podcast, but
definitely
these things sort of came together and were almost a bit of a sort of fuck this moment, in that why I started doing this, the Insta and the TikTok and venting my frustrations and doing something productive, because I realized as a breaking point that this route of work, the conventional path of being employed by other people, does not suit me at all. I need to be the master of my own destiny here, in control of what I am doing. And also a recognition that I'm not really employable. I am a disruptor after all, right? Unless I am fortunate enough to find a team of people who are very like-minded and I can get on with, in most places, I'm going to be a pain in the arse. I'm going to be a thorn in the side to them. And that for me was another sort of breaking point in wanting to make the change and go down this route now, where I want to pursue the creator economy and do something creative that I'm actually rewarded by.
Yeah, 100%. That's a good break. I like that. I think you're the first person who's talked about their breaking point and then talked about the solution to their breaking point as well. So that's good, because that doesn't go along with what you spoke about earlier when you spoke about your default is to become resentful. So your default there was to tell me the problem and then the solution to the problem as well. So that's really good. Fair play to you.
It's important. It's something that I've learned. Probably.
It is important too.
I can probably thank my employer for that, actually, because my whole job is centered around providing solutions to problems in business. And I would highly recommend for a lot of people actually that are ambitious and struggle with their mental health to get involved with some of these influencers or pay attention to some of these influencers who they might seem a bit cringy at times. They are often the more sort of like grind set aspiring entrepreneur types, but there is something that you can learn from them. You might not be able to relate to them philosophically. They might not be as analytical and intellectual, but they can actually look at things from a business and solution perspective that you can benefit from. And it's sort of a wider thing of paying attention to multiple different mindsets and different philosophies and ways of looking at life, because you can pick and choose from them and see which parts can help you. But for a lot of people, this generation in particular that are struggling, if they started working on a solution to help themselves, they will often start to feel better. And who knows what might come from it. They may feel significantly better long-term if it pays off.
That's a great bit of advice, actually. Find a problem and work to solve it. Right. Thank you everyone for watching. This has been another episode of the Breaking Point podcast. It was an intense one. It was a good one. And I've had a great time. Ollie, have you had a good time?
I have indeed. It's been an intellectually stimulating conversation. It's a good way to spend a Tuesday afternoon.
Absolutely. To say the least, it's been an intellectually stimulating conversation. I've got a lot to learn from Ollie, and he's probably got to learn to me. So I hope that we can continue talking and do this again. And yes, thank you for watching, and I will see you on the next one. I'm a bit shell-shocked, so that was a bit crap, but we'll go with it.